Category B6, Sports Programme, Off the Ball.
Now, on yesterday's programme, we played out an interview that we did with Emma O'Reilly about her new book, which is called Race to Truth, which is about her relationship with Lance Armstrong, David Walsh, the doping culture in cycling, and the sport itself, all up for discussion. It's quite confusing to think that somebody who was as villainous as Lance Armstrong was can be forgiven by somebody he hurt so spectacularly like Emma O'Reilly. Naturally, you'd be a bit suspicious of Lance, a point that I did raise with Emma O'Reilly. Just here's a few bits from that.
Given that he used everybody so horribly along the way to get to the top, at what point do you get comfortable that he's not just using you again?
I have to go on my instinct. My instinct says he's not.
He manages to convince you of that, though, at some point.
I guess I haven't asked him, in a sense. And I guess, too, say with bringing over the newspapers, that was my choice. And I gave him, I remember I emailed him, I phoned him, and I text him to say, you're up to something. What are you up to?
Yeah.
You don't let go of control. And he's gone, nothing. And I did that. And I then still emailed him again, even though when I spoke to him, so I kind of heard him. He had to text me, but he then had to email me it. And I'm still going, now, come on. You know, and so even right to meeting him, that's why I took someone with me to kind of protect my interests. So I still didn't fully trust him. That kind of come probably since our meeting. You know, and it's one thing I even said to Matt, the journalist, he's going, watching, he might. And I said, I'll tell you one thing about Lance. He's told me a few times that he's got no agenda. He just wants to meet me. He's bringing no one. I said, he attacks from the front. You know what's coming if he's going to go. So I guess in that sense, from my perspective, I'm not clever enough to go with people's agendas. I can take someone if they're coming at me from head first.
Yeah, well, you're a very reliable witness from his perspective, you saying that you now forgive him and trust him, there's about five or six people in the world who, if he gets that from those people, then the rest of the world can go, oh, that's all right, we can get past this now.
Do you think, though, because I think everybody's entitled to their opinion, and just because I say something or I've moved on to
But you're a very powerful person in this. It goes back to the point of that you made in the interview with David Walsh. You're a hugely important source.
I suppose I can sit there and say, and I wouldn't have thought I was an important source, and that's probably one of the things where David and I miscommunicated.
But now you're a very powerful source for people to go, okay, well, people are beginning to get over what Lance did to them. People like Emma are beginning to forgive him what happened. Yeah. And maybe that is hugely beneficial to him.
Maybe, but it's hugely beneficial to me.
Well, that's the...
It's been great for me because I've gone back to being who I used to be, that I'm much lighter and kind of more young at heart, freer.
Yeah.
And also I kind of feel as human beings in a civilised society, it's not part of being mature and being civilised, actually forgiving and forgetting and learning from things.
Betsy Andrea was another key witness in all this. She was a strong voice against the biggest doper in the history of sport, despite the great personal toll it had the potential to wreak on her family. And we're very grateful to Betsy Andrea for joining us now. Betsy, you've listened to Emma O'Reilly's interview on Off the Ball last night. What did you make of it?
I was pretty surprised. I had to rewind when I was listening because I thought, did she really say what I thought she said? So I was pretty stunned, and I thought you did a very good job.
What was it that stunned you?
That she doesn't think she's being used. I mean, if we look at Lance's history, he is a masterful manipulator, and I understand the complete forgiveness aspect of this because right after he called, I went on TV in America, on national TV, and I said, you know what, let's give him a chance. I am a practicing Catholic, and I understand that forgiveness is a tenet of my religion. And so I think it's a learning lesson. This is a learning lesson with so many, in so many aspects. And so I wanted to forgive him. And so for 3 months, I kept in touch with Lance. And I wanted him to meet with Travis and tell him everything. I wanted him to give David Walsh an interview. I wanted to meet with him. And he said, okay, we will meet. For the 3 months that I was played, and I'm very embarrassed to say I was fooled, he kept me at bay. He kept me quiet. He shut me up. I wasn't critical of him. I said, let's give him a chance. I went to Austin, Texas, and at the 11th hour, he refused to meet with me. And I said, that's it. I know he's playing me. Because all along, during these 3 months, you can say you're sorry, but actions speak louder than words. And so when I see that he's still blaming Travis, that he's still going after David Walsh, that he still won't talk about the hospital room because of legal reasons, like he told me, then I know that he really is not contrite. He's doing it to now attempt to rewrite history. And you made an excellent point. If he can get Emma on his side, then people will say, oh, my gosh. You know, if one of his fiercest critics forgive him, then why can't Betsy Andreu just shut up and do the same? I tried to tell Emma, he's using you, Emma. He's using you. She knows what he did with me. She knows that he's still blaming Travis, refusing to meet with David. And I never heard back from her. Never heard back from her. And really, and then people, how can I not be angry when I see how he's using her? When I see that he's giving interviews and he's lying and being disingenuous? I didn't read her book, but I've had some people send me excerpts from it. And I got to tell you, it really does get me upset, because when she gives Lance carte blanche to say that I'm nuts and crazy because I sent him an email and she doesn't explain the story behind it, I'm thinking, you are doing exactly what he wants you to do.
Do you want to explain about the email? Just we'll cover that bit. In the book, there's a bit where the team are up looking over the course of the tour, and Lance turns to Emma and says something along the lines of, Betsy's crazy, and I don't know if he actually shows her the email, but there's a reference to an email that you've written, and then that's the end of that. It's not like, well, you know, there's no context for it.
No, and the thing was that Frankie and Lance got into an argument at Amstel Gold in April, and Lance had threatened Frankie and said that he had the power to make sure he would never ride the Tour de France again, that he had the power that he was full of power. And so I wrote Lance back and I said, who in the hell do you think you are threatening Frankie not to ride the Tour? You don't treat people with respect. We don't have to put up with it, and we're not going to put up with your disrespectful attitude. So that's where that came from. But she doesn't put that in context. And so it's just, what, is Lance doing his bidding through Emma now?
World Cup fever obviously building, but it's been a week of some bittersweet moments as well here in the Off the Ball offices. We obviously wave goodbye to Joe Molloy. He's off to Brazil this weekend. Luckily, as you learned live on air on Tuesday night, he'll have a travelling companion, best friend forever, Emma Malone.
Love. Exciting
end. Emma, when do you fly out?
Sunday.
Sunday?
Yeah.
Okay.
How about yourself, Joe?
Sunday.
Well, hey.
What flight are you on?
I'm going through London anyway. I'm flying from London.
Whoa. I'm going through London as well.
Oh, that's very exciting. It's very exciting, yeah.
But then I'm on to Salvador after that.
Me too.
What?
Yeah. To the Spain-Netherlands game.
Spain-Netherlands. Oh. And are you sticking around for Germany-Portugal?
I am indeed.
Oh. Wow.
Excellent. So we've got a holiday planned.
Sensational. This is great. I mean, I'll see you there, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
A cause for adventure. Do you remember the Love Boat?
Yeah.
RT1 filled out the mid-afternoon schedule with it. So you get home from school and there'd be Knots Landing in the Love Boat to ruin
Knots
your afternoon.
Knots Landing.
I was thinking about it yesterday coming over on the plane. And the way I feel about the fight is that, you know, for me to become world champion, it would be a change in my reality. It'd be a change in my mentality. It was something that I've been trying for my whole life, and I had the chance to do that on Saturday night.
There's the right hook again. The amazing telling punch. The right hook of Andy Lee.
It looked like Andy had been hurt, and then all of a sudden, Harbaugh gets whacked, and Andy Lee swarms him.
I will win. I will be world champion, and it's just a matter of going in there and doing it now.
Watching in Ireland.
Yeah,
WBO middleweight world title is coming back to Limerick. He was with us, as you heard there, on Tuesday, and he said he'd do it. Well, Andy Lee, you got it done.
Yeah, did as I did. yeah, it's great. And thank you guys for the support before the fight and now after the fight. It's been great.
Congratulations. You must be just delighted.
Yeah, exactly. And it's joy and it's relief. And it's just... I can't even describe it, really. You know, just to have done it after so many years of wanting it and trying for it and working towards it, towards being a world champion, it's happened now and it feels great.
Have you spent your time since the fight? Has this been a wild party and out and not sleeping and jumping up and down, or has it been maybe a calmer, deeper kind of enjoyment?
A bit of both. After the fight, we went back into the dressing room and just all of us gathered there. All of my coaches, coaching staff, and some friends and my wife and family members who came to the fight. And it was just a great feeling. We put music on and we just sat in the dressing room, just, you know, took photos with the belt. Yeah. And enjoyed it and relived the fight. And that's basically what we've been doing since. And nothing too hectic, nothing too crazy. Just meeting people and people who've been here on the days when I wasn't champion, and people who have been behind me and helped me, and just talking to them on the phone and meeting them in person, and just basically it, you know, and just enjoying it and you know, taking in with the people that matter, really.
It's amazing. If you had, I mean, because we were wondering, I don't know what you thought a year ago or 18 months ago, it seemed like, you know, this mightn't happen for you. If you had retired, I know Matthew Macklin has said it, if you had come to the end and had never won a world title, would you have looked back ultimately with regret?
Yeah, and not regret, not so much, but disappointment, because there are, like, you know, there are always opportunities that you think you should have, or fights that get cancelled, and it's hard to come back from that. You know, it's boxing, as the life of being a professional boxer is full of letdowns and disappointments, and you can get disillusioned with it very easily.
I thought three years ago, listening to you at one stage, you seemed very disillusioned.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of good fighters, better fighters than me, just throw the hat at it, because it's such a political minefield. Like, trying to get through and trying to get the right fight, you got to have the right you got to have the right promoters and all this and that. And
sure,
it's treacherous, but if you keep working hard and keep, you know, I've said this a couple of times now, you persevere and work hard for what you believe in and what you think you're capable of and believe in yourself.
Yeah.
Eventually it'll happen, you know what I mean? So, yeah, I'm very lucky that has happened for me.
This year's number one Christmas stocking filler is No Bullshit, the brand new autobiography by former Gaelic football stalwart Colm Woolley Parkinson.
The Laois Minor glory years, my international rules hell, from Portlaoise to Parnells and back again, how I saved off the ball, and I tell the true story about the Mick O'Dwyer years and how we buried the hatchet after a chance meeting at Dublin Zoo. It's all there in my new book, No Bullshit, the Woolley Parkinson story, available in all good bookshops today.
This is where Kilkenny are considered their strongest. Like, you know, you catch Kilkenny in a semi-final because they're masters at all Ireland finals. And if you stay ahead of them, then, you know, you're ahead of the game, and it's yours. It's yours to control. And then you're talking about, you know, if you're chasing the game, you know, like we were against Kilkenny in the last 10 minutes. You know, they pack the back and they make life very, very difficult for you. So there's only one way to play against Kilkenny, and that's ahead.
Yeah, Seamus, generally if you stay ahead, you'll win the game, all right, you know. So I think, look, definitely Kilkenny this year, their strength and depth is definitely in the panel. I think last year I think against Cork, Kilkenny probably didn't have the strength and depth on the bench. But this year I think they can really turn to some serious game changers.
Who are fit?
Like you have Richie Power. He came in. You see what he did against Limerick the last day. Mm-hmm. There's men there this year you're not even talking about. The likes of Aidan Fogarty, Tommy Welsh, right. John Power. You know, there are, any of them could come in and make a massive difference on Sunday. And we have Henry there as well, Walter Welsh. You know,
Lester
so
Ryan.
The strength and depth. And the lads are on Lester Ryan. The lads are on about Tipperary and Lara Corbett maybe holding on to his place. And they're saying the strength and depth is not there in Tip. I think Tip are really, with Mickey Cahill injured and don't have the strength and depth in the forwards, Kilkenny definitely hold the aces, I think, on the bench.
Okay, we've got time for one final question for you.
Yeah, another one here.
Hi, lads. Seamus, you said in the semi-final that Kilkenny brought intensity to the game. I don't think it's fair to say that they beat you just because of intensity. And I think when a team says that, it's a bit of a cop-out.
Jesus.
Kilkenny might have a trick on a lot of teams that they don't actually realise. It's not just intensity that they're bringing, it's something else, and that maybe Michael could fill us in what they're bringing that other teams don't know about.
Ingredient X.
Wooly, Wooly?
No, I'm not at all. But I just add to that, and it is on what Seamus said. I didn't put him up to that question at all. But when a lot of teams do try to match Kilkenny's intensity and you're talking in the dressing room, if you do that, you'll be able to beat them.
Yeah.
Michael, what do you talk about in the dressing room? What will you be saying in the dressing room before, or Cody be saying before the Tip game?
Just a totally different question.
Hey, sorry, Colin. Who's asking the questions down there? You do your job, will you?
All I heard was, tell him nothing, Michael. Okay, you can answer that question.
Will we take the first question there, Colin? Yeah.
I'm interested in the second one. It's not a bad question, in fairness.
Yeah, no.
Well, I do get paid for my questions.
It's actually my question.
But not your football, obviously.
Jerry, you're asking me how to beat Kilkenny. I don't know. I never played against Kilkenny, so...
If you remember, the incident that happened just before the game, or the atrocity... Some terrorists came into a pub watching a game and went up to the on Halloween, on the 31st of October, and went up to the crowd trick-or-treat with a machine gun and shot a load of Irish fans, shot them dead. And that happened days, maybe a week or so before the game. And that was difficult, because to think that football even had any place in all that was frightening, and still chills me to this day, because the one thing I would say to you, and it was... The toughest memory I have in football is listening to the crowd in Northern Ireland sing Trick or Treat while we're playing on the pitch shortly after that incident. And I'm sure it's been well said at the time, you know, the Northern Ireland manager, Billy Bingham, wasn't trying to stop that by any stretch of the imagination. And it was a real tough time. And we qualified for a World Cup on the most extraordinary of evenings. And we came through the issue. And Alan speaks well in his book about on the way up to the ground and with the British soldiers and the kids who we thought were going to be kids like all kids and look for autographs. And they actually, it was like military. They kneeled down the front row of them and went like that and pretended they had guns. And then the one stepped up behind them. It was the most horriblest thing. And of course, there was all armoured cars bringing us in. And it stayed with me for a long time. But a man who's passed away since changed everything for me that night. And that was Alan MacDonald. He was the captain of Northern Ireland. He was from a very tough unionist part of Belfast. And he came into our dressing room and broke down the barriers that everybody else was afraid to go near. He wished us well at the World Cup finals. He was a proud Irish Islander. And he strengthened me that night to understand what sport can do.
After the game?
After the game, we had got through. Denmark had failed to beat Spain, I think, and we were all watching it on a monitor. We went into the dressing rooms afterwards. We didn't know whether to be happy because of the atrocities that had happened. It was an awful atmosphere all night. And Alan MacDonald came in, and he gave a speech. He didn't just say, well done. And that was the moment when I knew sport can beat everything. You know, and we'd come through this situation. We were heading off, and this awful things that were happening, sport won the day.
The thing about those atrocities is that they're just so close to the ceasefire in the kind of the, you know, in the overall scheme of the 30 years of the Troubles and the 3,000 people who were killed and the incredible bloodshed in the early 70s, that these ones, which are the most violent and awful, are so close to the ceasefires, ultimately, which lead us to peace and the situation that we have now, that that makes them even more grim because of that.
Yeah, it does. And you look back at all the numbers that you say, and you obviously want to think that it should never have happened, and you fail to understand the issues at the time when you're away in it. We were only 80, 90 miles away here, but I grew up, the most I knew when I grew up was there was black flags during the hunger strikes and outside windows in our estate where we lived. That's as close as any trouble ever got to me. And that night, again, it all came home to me. There was a guy, Gary Campbell from Belfast, who played at Arsenal as a kid with me, and when we got our summer holidays, he came down to me for a few days, and I was astonished. He went, "You can't come up with me." You know, like, so that was in the 80s. And I didn't really get it. I said, "I'm not afraid. I'll go." "No, I'm telling you, you're not coming up." And so it was always there, but with something that, you know, as youngsters, sport was taking us through all that anyway. But again, I say, you know, Alan McDonald, who passed away since, tragically very young, died on the golf course up in Northern Ireland a few years ago. Moments like that make you always believe that sport will win through. And ultimately, the bigotry evaporates and disappears. News Talk 106 to 108.